rätselhafte Todesfälle, naturwissenschaftlicher Tiefgang und Empfehlungen, wie Sie den Alltag möglichst unbeschädigt überleben. Hallo, hier spricht Florian Klenk und am Freitag, den 26. April 2024, läuft die dritte Staffel von Klenk und Reiter, dem Falter-Podcast aus der Gerichtsmedizin. Christian Reiter und ich kredenzen Ihnen jeden Freitag einen neuen Fall. Sie finden uns auf falter.at/Gerichtsmedizin und überall dort, wo es Podcasts gibt.
Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen im Falterradio. Im Ukraine-Krieg sind die Fronten festgefahren. Die Russische Föderation hat ein Fünftel des ukrainischen Territoriums erobert und hält ganze Landstriche, Dörfer und Städte besetzt. Aber die ukrainischen Verteidiger halten ihre Stellungen. Die Lieferung moderner Waffen aus dem Westen ermöglicht es, den ukrainischen Streitkräften immer wieder den Angriffen standzuhalten. Furchtbare Verbrechen sind Teil dieses Krieges. Als unabhängige Journalistin berichtet Olga Tokariuk aus der Ukraine. Tokariuk hat für Nachrichtenagenturen und Radiosender in Westeuropa und in den USA gearbeitet. Sie war Auslandschefin des ukrainischen TV-Senders Hromadske TV. Dessa Šiškovits hat Olga Tokariuk in der Westukraine erreicht. Die ukrainische Journalistin beschreibt die Rolle der Oligarchen in der Medienwelt, warum es so viele arbeitslose Reporter gibt in der Ukraine und wie objektiver Journalismus unter den Bedingungen der russischen Aggression funktionieren kann. Das Gespräch wurde in englischer Sprache geführt.
Welcome, Olga Tokariuk. Thank you very much for joining us today. You are in the middle of the war as a journalist. I mean, it's one of the most dramatic things that happens in the world today. And journalism often is complicated between objectivity and facts and fake news and all this, what happens all around us. But your situation is absolutely precarious. And we want to talk today about how the situation is for you to work on the ground, what problems arise to be a thinking political person in a job that is supposed to be an objective way of bringing information to the world, how that works out for you, and also how you anticipate, of course, also the political development a little bit, if that's okay. So welcome to this interview, to this podcast, to Falter.
Hello, Tessa, and thank you for having me. Well, you know, I'm affected by this war, obviously, as a person and as a journalist, because as a Ukrainian, I'm living this war also on a personal level. You know, when it started, I had to take care of my family, to move them to what seemed to be a safer part of Ukraine, which is the west of the country. Although, as we have seen that during this month, Russia launched missiles on various parts of Ukrainian territory, including here, the west of the country. So actually nowhere in Ukraine is completely 100% safe. Like, you don't know if it's safe today, whether it will be safe tomorrow. But, you know, this decision not to leave Ukraine, just to move to another part of Ukraine, it was actually connected to the fact that I'm a journalist and that I wanted to stay in Ukraine to continue reporting, to continue telling international media, especially since I speak foreign languages and I've been collaborating as freelance correspondent in Ukraine with various media from Italy, Spain, UK, US for many years. So, you know, it was like a conscious decision to stay in Ukraine, although in a safer part of it, and continue reporting continue telling what is happening. You know, I was never a war reporter. It was never a war reporter. It was never my dream or my ambition to be a war reporter, unlike a lot of my other colleagues for whom it was somehow, you know, this kind of a landmark, something to strive for, like that if you are reporting from the conflict zone, from a war zone, this kind of means that you are really doing real, you know, top-notch journalism. I have background as international news reporter, but mostly reporting on politics, social issues, not conflict. And that's also the reason why I'm not reporting from the front line. I'm staying in the rear most of the time. So either here in Western Ukraine, also in Kyiv, I'm visiting Kyiv, I'm visiting areas that were under Russian occupation, but since have been liberated since, like Irpin, Bucha, or Chernihiv, where I just returned from. So I'm reporting from, you know, other parts of Ukraine, because war not only means frontline, war not only means destruction of the houses and deaths of people, war also affects everyone in different ways, you know, even in the those parts of Ukrainian territory, those cities and towns and villages that are not on the front line, that maybe are not subjected to everyday fighting. But everyone and every inch of Ukrainian territory is affected by this war. And I'm trying to report those stories, mostly focusing on human stories, how people, you know, they live this war, how they are affected. And in fact, like as, let's say, this war went on and the international media attention started to fade away slowly, the breaking news that were there for initial several weeks and months were not as breaking anymore. Somehow the public started to get used to, you know, that there is war in Ukraine and that every day people die and there is destruction every day. It is not the news anymore. And I was kind of thinking, how should I, as a journalist, reshape also my approach and change my reporting, considering this, considering that, you know, I receive less interest from international media to comment, to give interviews, as this attention is fading away. And my answer was that I should focus on the issue of documentation of Russian war crimes and human rights abuses, because I think this is one of the most remarkable, significant aspects of this war, is that Russia is not only fighting the Ukrainian military, but it's also fighting with Ukrainian civilians, and actually more civilians, according to some estimates, are you know, have been killed and injured in this war, even more than Ukrainian military. So I think this is a very kind of peculiar aspect of this war, of this Russian aggression against Ukraine, the situation of civilians and the abuses and the war crimes against civilian population. So I'm trying to focus on that more, to tell, you know, the stories of these civilians, to give them voice, which they often lack because they might not be speaking foreign languages, or journalists are not able to reach them because it's, you know, difficult to get this context. So in cooperation also with some Ukrainian human rights defenders, human rights NGOs, you know, we've been and we've known each other for many years, because I also covered human rights related issues in the past before this full scale invasion. So now in cooperation with these human rights NGOs, you know, we are trying to give voice to these people, to tell their stories, to raise the attention, to draw the attention of the, you know, international media and wider public in the world to these war crimes and human rights abuses that Russia is committing in Ukraine.
That might make you, of course, even more a target than as if you would go to the front line, because as we have seen, Russia doesn't like having the war crimes reported, and especially not the ones against civilians. So how do you protect yourself?
Well, mostly targeting online, you know, like I receive, yeah, some hateful comments on social media also, because I have quite like a high profile on Twitter. Like a lot of people are following me and are interested in what I'm, you know, reporting. And also there, I conduct this so-called Twitter spaces, which are like podcast in a way, this format that is very similar to a podcast where I invite actually the witnesses of these human rights abuses. I invite Ukrainian human rights activists, Ukrainian lawyers, Ukrainian activists, Ukrainian officials, like government officials who are dealing with these topics. So yeah, there is a lot of interest, in fact, and I see that like really a lot of people are very curious to learn more. Also, like thanks to this platform, I was able to put in touch many international journalists who might listen, you know, to my Twitter space, and then they reach out to me in a private message, or they reach out to me on email and offer, you know, like either they ask for contacts to put them in touch with those people that I invite, or they, you know, offer like a cooperation. They say, let's do something together, like let's make a story. So I'm working now on a project with some international journalists, specifically on the issue of human rights abuses on filtration camps. And so, you know, I think like the most important thing is that I see more good than harm in what I do. I mean, there's some online abuse or offenses that I get, like some slur in the comment section, I really like tend to ignore it, you know, because it will happen inevitably. We are living in a digital world, and we know that Russia has people whom it pays to spread disinformation online, and also to harass, to attack people that it doesn't like. So yeah, I'm of course taking digital precautions also, like on my social media accounts and my email. But not much than that. Like I'm not like particularly concerned, also because I think I'm maybe measuring my situation in comparison with other people. And I still tend to think that those who are on the front line risk more, you know, because like it's completely unpredictable. It's not like under your control what can happen from one moment to another when you are in the front line. Here, I kind of feel that I'm more in control because at least I can do things to protect, you know, my accounts like digitally to be on the safe side. But of course, like it's never 100% certainty. Still, I'm not put off by any like of this kind of potential threats or real like online threats. I'm still like, I think that it's important to speak up. It's important to, you know, continue like reporting, giving voice to people and telling what is happening. And I will do that, whatever happens. I'm determined to continue doing that.
I mean, since 2014, I read that there were 15 journalists and media people were killed in the war that Russia increasingly inflicts on the Ukraine. So it is a really super dangerous situation, even if you're not going to the front line to report, and it will probably become more dangerous. But what I wonder, which is probably even more complicated for you to negotiate at the moment than your personal safety, is how to stay an objective journalist in a situation where you necessarily become sort of an actor in this conflict, because the more you report on it and you see the injustice that is happening, I can imagine it's very complicated to stay calm and cool-headed in your reporting.
Well, obviously, we are all humans, you know, and especially if you're in the middle of it and your friends are dying and people you know, like your colleagues, journalists, but also your friends from other spheres of life, they are killed by Russia in this war, or they're taken as prisoners of war, or they just disappear. And of course, you know, like watching all the suffering that Russia inflicts on civilians, it of course affects you. So as a human, of course, I'm affected by that. As a professional, I think I'm quite a rational person, you know, and I take a break, let's say, like when, you know, something happens and I feel I'm like really emotional, I'm not rushing to, you know, say something about it or write or, you know, like share what I feel. Like I'm taking a pause, like I'm you know, taking a break, like inhale, exhale, and like try to calm down and, you know, be objective and speak about the facts. I think this is like kind of the main rule that guides me as a journalist: stick to the facts and give voice to people, like not try to, you know, be yourself at the center of attention, like be a kind of a medium for the people, who were affected, you know, who are like the primary sources, who are those who might not be able to formulate like the what they've seen and what they, you know, experienced in a such a good way as you as a journalist can, because you are more familiar with words, you know how to put things like frame them kind of in a narrative, in a nice like article or, I don't know, piece for TV or radio. Like I'm working as a journalist for more than 15 years. I know how to do that. And, you know, people who are not journalists, they might not. So I see my role as that of like a medium to give the voice to the people who have been affected immediately, you know, who are testimonies of Russian war crimes and human rights abuses, and who might otherwise not get their voices heard, or, you know, they might get their voices heard in the Ukrainian media space, but not outside of Ukraine. So I'm trying to, you know, do that, like stick to the facts, take a breath, not, you know, let emotions prevail, like take a pause and wait until my rationality kind of returns in the moments when I feel too emotional. And the third rule, kind of my rule of my, you know, professional life is to not be yourself at the center of attention, but give the voice to the people, let them speak. And sometimes I even have, you know, troubles with the editors, because in my articles, I include so many quotes, you know, that they like say, okay, formulate some of these quotes with your own words, because it's just like a lot of too many quotes, you know, it's like an interview, it's not an article. But it's because I think that it's important to let the people speak, like not try to speak for them, or, I mean, help them, but not replace, you know, like with yourself, with your persona, the people who are the real protagonists.
And do you have any restrictions from the Ukrainian government? I mean, we're always thinking of Russia wanting to change the narrative of this war in their favor. But is the Ukrainian government or the military, the army, PR department, are they checking what you do? Are they telling you don't report on something that lets us look unfavorably weak, for example, or that desertations happen in the army and it shouldn't be reported? Does that happen at all?
Well, I don't have personal experience of, you know, any similar incidents. Also, maybe because I'm mostly reporting for international audience, so they do not really like check what I'm writing. And in general, I think the Ukrainian military and, you know, the government offices are too busy with other things to check like what the journalists are, you know, writing, reporting. In general, while Ukraine had some issues with the freedom of speech, those were like minor issues. In general, there is freedom of speech in Ukraine, and the journalists can do, you know, their work properly without facing pressure from the government. It has been like this since 2014, since the you know, the government changed and Yanukovych fled, and, you know, like the pro-democratic forces were in charge of Ukraine. There are, of course, during the war, other concerns that sometimes the military kind of is reluctant to let the journalists visit some positions, which they think could be a security risk and could put, you know, soldiers at risk, like disclosing the exact locations of military objects or the positions of the Ukrainian army. That, of course, like is could be risky. And, you know, sometimes the journalists are not allowed, but I think it is understandable that it would happen in any other country. And another thing that I know that a lot of colleagues, especially foreigners, are facing is like a very slow process of accreditation. Like the Ministry of Defense has been quite slow in issuing accreditation to cover, you know, the war from the front line. So some people were waiting for weeks and months to get this accreditation, like really, really slow process. Well, they were saying that they have too many requests and they just like can't keep up with all of them and process them. I've heard that there were some improvements recently, but it remains still a problem. But from, you know, the experience of like visiting not the frontline regions, but the regions that were under occupation or were, you know, were affected by Russian missile strikes like heavily, such as Chernihiv, for example, or, you know, Bucha, Irpin, Kyiv, I can say that I didn't really experience any obstacles there. There are, of course, the checkpoints where, you know, the entry of any like major city where the military are checking the documents of everyone that enters. But usually, like when, you know, me and my colleagues, we are showing our press IDs, like it's no problem. They let you pass. And on the contrary, in fact, I see that there is a lot of willingness, not maybe, you know, the Ministry of Defense or military officials, but like the other Ukrainian government officials and also local authorities, there is a lot of like eagerness and willingness to talk to journalists, maybe even more than it used to be before, because they want also, you know, international media to continue speaking about Ukraine, not forget about the war, because, you know, it's not as much as it used to be on the front pages. It's not as much as it used to be on TV and radio. So they are aware of that. And, you know, like those journalists who are still in Ukraine or who have just come in Ukraine, like mostly if approached in a correct, ethical, you know, nice manner, respectful manner, like most requests are being satisfied, like for interview, and pretty quickly, sometimes like even like really very quickly, from, you know, having an experience of working as international news correspondent in many countries. I remember that like the country where usually I had like the fastest response times was Poland. And I was amazed, you know, like that you can come on the same day, you call someone and the same day you can get the interview. So now I observe that similar things are happening in Ukraine. Like the officials are really very open. It of course depends, like if it's a first lady or, you know, the prime minister or the minister of foreign affairs, who are like super busy, of course, like it will take longer. But if it's local authorities or you know, a minister of some not as loaded, like not as busy as others ministry, then like it fairly in a fair amount of time you'll get like the, you know, the meeting, the interview organized, and also like can work in a field without too many obstacles for you.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
International reporters coming now to the Ukraine are also seen more as, as you said, as an advantage to get the message out, and they're welcomed probably more than rejected. But how is the Ukrainian media internally doing? I mean, I know you work mostly for foreign media, but you know, you have oligarchs owning the main channels and private channels, and you know, is the feeling among Ukrainian journalists that they can report on that war in an objective manner? Are there restrictions within the Ukrainian media or certain perspective that has to be kept?
Well, frankly, there are a lot of changes in the Ukrainian internal media scene since the start of this war. I think like one of major changes was that since the full-scale invasion started on February 24th, several big TV stations, they united their editorial teams to conduct this 24/7 marathon on TV. So, you know, like reporters from different TV stations were contributing to creating the same like marathon. And this marathon was broadcast on different TV stations that joined this effort. So it was not like, you know, a separate different sort of like broadcasting when you are like zapping your TV channels. Usually like, yeah, it's different on different channels. But in Ukraine, it was very that four or five, or I don't remember exactly, but like several major TV stations, they joined like this effort, and they were broadcasting the same content that was created by their teams that were kind of working in cooperation. They still like might have been, you know, physically distanced, like working in their separate newsrooms, but the content that they created was the same. But there are also several like issues and concerns about this 24/7 marathon, because when initially in the first like weeks and months of war, it was perceived as something like really useful, you know, also keeping kind of people not only informed, but keeping people's spirits up, you know, trying to maintain this like spirit of resistance and resilience of the Ukrainian society. After a while, this TV marathon, if I can call it like this, started to get like criticized more and more that it was not really providing an objective picture of what is happening. You know, it was like basically this government kind of propaganda in a way. So it was not like really objective, content of what is really happening. This is the criticism that is coming mostly like from the civil society and also from like journalists of some like independent other media who do not participate in this project. I mean, it is also kind of arguable because you can argue that in the war, it's also something kind of more acceptable than in normal times, that maybe in the UK during the World War II, you know, they were also broadcasting all this propaganda, kind of patriotic on the radio. And it also helped the war effort to keep, you know, the people like fighting and the spirits up. So yes, like it is understandable why some people would say that it is fine, but it is also, you know, kind of something that shouldn't be like okay and probably was not acceptable, wouldn't be acceptable in peace times. And of course, there are like a lot of journalists who are saying like, okay, thankfully we are not working there. You know, we can like report independently what is really happening. So like that's one thing. And another thing, you touched upon the issue of the oligarchs and that a lot of media are owned by the oligarchs. And one of the already like consequences of this war was that one of the richest Ukrainian oligarchs, Rinat Akhmetov, who used to own a big media empire, he basically gave up on this media empire. And he said that, well, he justified it with the deoligarchization law that was passed before the war. So he said that due to this war, like he has to come kind of like transfer the licenses for his TV stations. And he owned two kind of current affairs TV stations, one like all news TV channel and another TV channel, like one of the most popular also that broadcasted either news but also entertainment content, and several like smaller TV stations. So he said like he's returning to the state the licenses for this TV stations, and all the staff of this TV stations was kind of fired. And it happened just like last week, you know, like with some of these people I used to work before. So I'm like, we'll keep seeing their posts in which they say kind of their farewell to, you know, these TV stations. And suddenly we have a lot of jobless journalists in Ukraine. So this is only like the latest example, but there were also other journalists who were losing their jobs in the first months, like after the war started, because, for example, those journalists who were previously doing politics, conflict reporting, they were still needed. But those who were doing entertainment, who were doing like social, you know, coverage, like education, suddenly they were not needed. And many TV stations, especially like private owned, they told them, well, either, you know, you kind of leave this job like on your own, or we send you on an unpaid indefinite leave. So, and many of them actually like chose to, you know, okay, quit this job and look for another one, because like they can't stay for months and indefinite unpaid leave. They have to provide for their families. Some of them fled abroad, so with their children, like my female colleagues. So it was already a problem like before this situation with Akhmetov's channels. So currently we really have like a lot of jobless journalists in Ukraine. A lot of journalists also from the local media are suffering, because, you know, the all country media, they have more resources, usually more money, more abilities to support their staff to continue their operations. But the local newsrooms and local newspapers and online media and radio stations, they are suffering more because they are losing access to funding, and especially those from east of Ukraine, from Donbas, from other areas. And I know personally also some journalists from Donbas who are working in the local media. They had to flee, obviously, because of Russian offensive there. They're now scattered around Ukraine. Some of them are in Kyiv. Some of them are in Lviv or in Dnipro. But they continue like working because they also had some contacts previously with international organizations, like some, you know, those who provide the funding, or governmental organizations of foreign governments who provide the funding for independent media. So they kind of still try to struggle, but they continue operating in this change in circumstances, where they also like had to move, they had to leave all their equipment behind. You know, the newsrooms they had in Mariupol have been destroyed, or in Bakhmut in Donetsk region. So like a lot of issues for journalists on different levels, like this financial troubles, the fact that the oligarchs are getting rid of their media empire. And my actually reading of this situation with Akhmetov is that at some point he just thought he doesn't need it anymore. Like, he's losing part of his business in Donbass. He lost it due to, you know, Russian tax. And you know, oligarchs always needed the media somehow to advance their business interests. Mm. And now, you know, my reading of the situation, I might be wrong, but my interpretation is that he just, you know, says that, well, it doesn't make sense to spend so much money on maintaining this media empire when he's suffering so much, like so many losses. His businesses are suffering so many losses because, you know, Russia destroyed them, like in Mariupol or in other places. So it just doesn't make sense to invest, to continue investing in this media empire that is usually not bringing profits. Usually, like, in, you know, the oligarchs are not making money out of the media. They're making money out of the other businesses, and the media only serves to advance these interests.
How do you get information now from places like Mariupol that fell to the Russian army? I mean, is there some kind of underground media also from the Russian side, maybe, or is that all, has that all stopped?
No, it's super difficult. Like, all objective journalists were forced to flee Mariupol. You know, some of them faced pressure. I mean, not just in Mariupol, but in other parts of Donbass that fell under Russian occupation in Donetsk and Luhansk regions. I just like spoke recently with a woman who was from a town in Luhansk region. And as you know, like, now almost all of Luhansk region is under Russian occupation. And after, like, it fell under the occupation, she and other journalists who were working there in the local media, they were kind of summoned by this new so-called authorities, occupation authorities from Russia. And they were put pressure on, you know, like, try to, that they had to cooperate, that they had to make this, you know, new content, Russian propaganda, basically advocating that these regions are now Russian forever, and, you know, manufacturing all the stories about Ukrainian Nazis and so on and so forth. And she was able to, like, to leave, like, she, with the help of her contacts in government controlled area of Ukraine, she was able to leave after a long time when it was impossible, not safe to leave. So basically, you know, she had to go to all these, like, meetings with this new occupation authorities and kind of nod to their, you know, requirements, but also resist, like, quietly from actually, like, starting to collaborate with them, because, like, there you don't have much choice, or you collaborate or you have to leave, or you are put in a, you know, in a secret prison, you're tortured until you begin to collaborate. So she was able to leave, and she's now in Kyiv, and she joined, like, other journalists from Donbass who fled earlier. But this is, like, the most kind of recent case, because she left only, I think, 2 weeks ago, and she was able to tell what is actually happening to journalists who, you know, are in those areas under Russian occupation, how Russians are, like, putting pressure on them, blackmailing them, threatening also to harm their families if they refuse to collaborate. So getting, like, any objective information out of Mariupol from people who are actually there, it's virtually impossible. Mostly this information is kind of secondhand. It might be coming from journalists who are from Mariupol, but they fled, but they maintained contacts with people who stayed there. So it's like, kind of, they get in touch with their contacts in Mariupol who wish to remain anonymous in 100 or 99% of cases. And they are telling what is actually happening there. But this is not, like, the primary source. And those people who are staying in Mariupol will in most cases refuse to talk to other journalists than those whom they already, like, know, with whom they were in touch and, you know, live together in the same city. So it's, like, super, super difficult to kind of understand what's happening there. And of course, like, all the Russian propaganda press tours that they are bringing in, foreign journalists also in Mariupol, like, yeah, we can see the images, like, we can trust those, but not, you know, other things.
Das war die ukrainische Journalistin Olga Tokariuk im Gespräch mit Tessa Šeškovits. Ich verabschiede mich von allen, die uns auf UKW hören, im Freirad Tirol und auf Radio Agora in Kärnten. Aktuelle Informationen aus dem Ukraine-Krieg lesen Sie regelmäßig im Falter. Ein Abonnement des Falter kann man im Internet bestellen über die Adresse abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer hat die Signation gestaltet, Philipp Dietrich und Miriam Hübel betreuen die Audiotechnik im Falter. Ich verabschiede mich, bis zur nächsten Folge.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.